It's the TV people themselves who are threatened by the labeling, because that would destroy the myth that this is anything but a carefully crafted piece of propaganda fake news.
The GAO investigated government-funded video news releases last year. Why hasn't Congress or the FCC taken action?
Very good question. The General Accounting Office last year, and they actually they did it more than once. If you go to our website and you search fake news or GAO, you'll kick this stuff out, came out last year with a number of reports saying that the Bush administration's spending on outside public relations firm, and especially the unlabeled use of video news releases coming from federal departments, constitutes illegal propaganda. Ever since World War I, when the public relations industry was born in a Woodrow Wilson campaign that people like Ivy Lee and Eddie Bernays, the fathers of PR, organized to turn around American opinion on that war and get the U.S. into war, ever since the birth of the public relations industry and the recognition of the power of propaganda and its threat to democracy, we've had laws on the books in the United States saying the U.S. government shall not engage in propagandizing U.S. citizens. The Bush administration has just ripped up those laws. The General Accounting Office has no enforcement power. They do really great investigations. But unless Congress picks it up or the FCC picks it up or a public movement is organized around it, what the Bush administration has said is, well, that's fine, but according to an opinion from our attorney general, the GAO is wrong. This is simply public education. That's where the issue sits right now. But we now know that the Bush administration is spending hundreds of millions of dollars hiring outside PR firms, like the Lincoln Group, for instance, to plant fake news in Iraq. And the FCC position on video news releases is really tortured, and here's what it is, and it's completely inadequate. If you read the six-page statement that the FCC has on video news releases, and not only have we read it, together with Free Press, we forced them to open a docket and receive comment on it. And in our comments, our staff person, Dr. Diane Farsetta, pointed out that the FCC regulations are wholly inadequate, because what they say is if a video news release is political or if it is controversial, then it needs to be labeled as provided footage by TV stations wherever it's from. But if it's just commercial, then there's no requirement that it be labeled. Our position is, hey, this is TV journalism. When you take a provided commercial fake news story and air it as news, you're violating every fundamental ethic of journalism. You're engaged in plagiarism. Airing unlabeled video news releases is inherently controversial. And that's what we're going to be continuing to push and argue before the FCC. We need to have much stricter definitions of, you know, what constitutes the need, what triggers the need to label these VNRs. We have to have much better regulations, and we need to then get those regulations enforced, which is going to be incredibly difficult. What's interesting is the response of the TV, Radio, TV, and News Directors Association has been, hey, you're talking government censorship. We should be able to do whatever we want here in our newsroom. If we want to air these things, it's our right to air them. And in fact, I wouldn't contest their right to air them, but that's not the fight. The fight is whether they air them and inform us that it's provided footage and not real journalism, or whether they continue to engage in massive plagiarism and fool us into thinking this is TV journalism.
Do you see any parallel between the rhetoric now coming out of Washington on Iran and what happened before the invasion of Iraq?
Do I see any parallel between the rhetoric in Washington with Iran and what happened in the lead-up to the war in Iraq? Yeah, I see tremendous parallels, not just in the rhetoric from the administration, but also in the way that the mainstream news media, again, seems to sort of just be falling in line and parroting this. And frankly, if you look at the horrific mess that the war in Iraq has created, and the way that ever since 9/11, this administration has exploited its war on terror for political purposes, I don't see them backing up. I see them continuing to go forward, and especially with the statements of the Vice President and the Secretary of Defense recently, it really smells a lot like what happened taking us into the attack on Iraq.
The questioner mentioned the deliberate use of PR techniques by the Nazis and asked what hope today's journalism students had of finding honest work in the field.
Well, first of all, on the issue of Nazi propaganda, we, in Toxic Sludge is Good for You, our first book, we introduce Eddie Bernays. Eddie Bernays, one of the most important intellectuals and I would argue political activists of the last century. Most people have never heard of him, but he created the business of public relations. And to Eddie's credit, he really didn't mince words. He said, what I'm engaged in is propaganda, and let's just hope it's propaganda and not impropaganda. He wrote a book about public relations titled Propaganda, and he was proud to do what he did. Fascinating character. He was a double nephew of Sigmund Freud. And Eddie really learned all these techniques of manipulating emotions and understanding the unconscious. And it's sort of ironic because he promoted the heck out of Uncle Sigmund in America and then sort of promoted himself, tremendously successful self-promoter, as Freud's nephew. But it's rather ironic because, of course, Freud, whatever you think of Freudianism and Freud, you know, his idea was liberating people from the unconscious and the irrational and the emotional, where Eddie's whole thing was learning how to tap into those motivations to manipulate and manage people for his clients. And Eddie, didn't mince words. He really believed that democracies were untenable without an elite that managed public opinion. And he wrote things like this: the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. And this is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they're to live together as a smoothly functioning society. In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social contact or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind. And this is just frightening, I think, to most people. But this was Eddie's idea of how the public relations industry that he helped define and create and promote was essential. And we tell how, in his autobiography, Bernays recalls a dinner at his home in 1933 where, quote, Carl von Weigand, foreign correspondent of the Hearst newspapers, an old hand at interpreting Europe, and just returned from Germany, was telling us about Goebbels and his propaganda plans to consolidate Nazi power. Goebbels had shown Weigand his propaganda library, the best Weigand had ever seen. Goebbels, said Weigand, was using my book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, as a basis for his destructive campaign against the Jews of Germany. This shocked me. Obviously, the attack on the Jews of Germany was no emotional outburst of the Nazis, but a deliberate, planned campaign. And it's true. Joseph Goebbels was a PR master, like Eddie Bernays. And we like to think that, you know, maybe Bernays, who was at heart a liberal intellectual, you know, thought, oh my God, this force that I see as a force for democracy can just as effectively, under the right circumstances, be used to pull a democracy into a fascist state. I don't think Eddie learned much, because we know now from The Father of Spin, this great book by Larry Tye, who got into Eddie's 80 pages of boxes that he donated to the Library of Congress after he died 5 years ago at the age of 103, that Eddie, more than anyone else, was the mastermind, believe it or not, of the overthrow of the mildly reformist Arbenz government in Guatemala. Very frightening. But in terms of, you know, what can people do? I mean, I think it behooves us all as citizens to realize, certainly in my lifetime, I have never seen our country or our society in such a crisis of democracy. And again, I would go back to saying that unless we find ways to reclaim, revitalize, reinstitute critical thinking and challenging and investigative reporting, we are going to be continued to be drawn down this deadly, dangerous path that the administration has taken us with this war in Iraq. And there are lots of ways to get involved. Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, a great example of what you can do with almost no money in having a really substantive news program. You can take a look at the community radio stations around the country. There are 80 community radio stations around the country. I used to think this was rinky-dink. Then I went to Australia, where I saw the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and the huge impact it has in Rupert Murdoch's home country of combating the corporate conglomeration of the media there. In 9 years ago, I was in Australia for 8 days, I was on 25 different radio public affairs programs of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, spanning the spectrum from left to right. Every one of those programs was civil. Every one of those was interesting. No matter what the host or hostess felt politically, they were engaging. And it's really made a difference in Australia in understanding issues. You know, I think the web is the future. We're going to see more and more independent radio, independent video moving onto the web. And, you know, we have a really unique phenomenon in this country that's benefited this university tremendously, of philanthropy and foundations that are able to put lots of money into some really important things. And what I'm hoping is that more and more organizations like mine will arise, nonprofit, independent media organizations that will move to and be inspired by the sorts of examples that I described in Oh My News. There's tremendous potential out there, but we're going to have to fight for it, we're going to have to win it, and we are going to be confronting, you know, one of the most powerful corporate lobbies in this country, and that is the conglomerates that have taken over the news media business.
John Stauber, author and director of the Center for Media and Democracy, speaking at Ithaca College. For more info, visit www.prwatch.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever, and they despise a fool. Till you're so crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
This is Tim Scott. I'm in the studio with Loretta Alper, who is a producer with the Media Education Foundation, and Pepe Lystina, who is a professor of applied linguistics at UMass Boston. Loretta, you are a producer with Media Education Foundation, otherwise known as MEF.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about your job as well as what MEF is?
Sure. MEF is a nonprofit production organization based in Northampton, Massachusetts. We produce and distribute works that take a critical look at the way social issues are represented in the media. So we produce and distribute our own stuff pretty much nationally, sometimes a little bit internationally we get out there. We take what the media throws at us and we kind of talk back to the media.
You are in the process of releasing a new film called
Yes.
Class Dismissed.
Class Dismissed, How TV Frames the Working Class.
Where did the idea behind this film come from?
Well, I do a lot of work with media representation in the Applied Linguistics graduate program. I do this sort of cultural studies, critical social theory there. And essentially what we do in the applied side is work with linguistic minority students and then more so with the teachers that are going to be working with these students. And so we try to cut into issues of race and gender and class and sexuality and things that teachers are going to face in the classrooms. And so a lot of what I expose teachers to with multimedia take up those issues. And one of the things that was really missing was a video that really took up the history of class representations. And so I started to think about why that is. And I think it's indicative of what's problematic in the United States and that we don't name class. And so I thought we need to take a look at this and started taking a look at television and looking at the patterns of the images that were emerging, and then saw this crazy stuff that was going that was scapegoating and has historically been scapegoating the working class, and thought, I'm going to contact MEF and see if we can get this up and running. And it's such a great organization and taking up a lot of these critical issues, real substantive issues, that they picked it up.
Before we talk more about the film, I'd like to ask you both what your personal interest is in working class issues. Loretta?
Well, as Pepe said, class is an aspect of society that is hidden in plain sight, and we all have a class position and a class identity, but because of the way in which class issues, particularly in the media, have been distorted, clouded, misrepresented, or just plain ignored, we don't have a good kind of robust, healthy dialogue and debate about what class is and what it means for us. In the work that I do, I'm interested in looking at the way people's social positions and social identities get represented in the media, and class was, as Pepe said, something that MEF hadn't really looked at before. And it's also a subject that's near and dear to my heart as someone who grew up working class and who experienced, you know, sort of what it means to feel the kind of material effects of being working class, but not necessarily have a kind of deeper understanding of what that means, and in particular, the way that that gets kind of translated into the culture and the way that we understand who we are through the media representations.
And Pepe?
I mean, as a middle-class kid, I mean, growing up and being sort of taught not to look at this, sort of the social construction of not seeing, not looking at class issues, on a personal side became incredibly problematic for me. But on a professional side, as an educator, you know, for having taught for 15, 20 years, it's seeing schools as class-based institutions. I mean, they're microcosms of the macrocosm. They reflect a larger social order. And so, you know, this idea that schools are a level playing field is absolute nonsense. I mean, they're class-based. And so working-class kids and working-poor kids are in these institutions that are poorly funded. They're crumbling. They have poorly paid educators, poorly prepared educators, and so on and so forth. And so it's how class gets reproduced in these institutions that really started to connect my own personal politics with my professional politics. And so as a tax-based, as a tax-funded, primarily property tax-funded institution, you can see the inequities right off the bat. And so I have enormous problems with that. we decided to focus in on entertainment television. And so that's what Class Dismissed is doing. It's taking a look at how historically stereotypes have worked to scapegoat the working class and then see that articulation with race, gender, and sexuality.
I'm sure there could be a weekly television series about this issue.
Wouldn't we love to see that?
Well, sure. You know, there used to be. I mean, Class used to be a part of the public sphere when organized labor had more of a grasp on it. There were community-based radio stations like this fantastic station that you folks have really worked hard to put together, and it looks great, and I'm really psyched to be here. And by the way, thanks for having us. But, you know, in newspapers and newsletters and so on and so forth, and that media program has, as far as I'm concerned, relatively disappeared. And so it's important to kind of make sure that Class comes back and that we are able to distribute these kinds of ideas to get the public engaged in that debate again, because Class has disappeared.
Yeah, it seems like, and you probably found in your research, that this film is pretty unique, not only the topic, but just as far as any real type of educational film addressing class, of course, independent of, say, labor union educational films and such.
I think there have been some great videos on Class, alternative on the, you know, sort of edges and stuff, but they're usually about material struggle, which is really important, and organized labor, that's really important. I think what's been left out of that equation is representation, the cultural element, how images also play a substantive role in getting people to, you know, to think about themselves and think about their place within these class structures, or to not do so. And so what the film is trying to do is sort of take the political economy aspect, right, and link it with the representational cultural aspect and show that, you know, these are formative media. They're not just expressive or reflective of reality. They're pedagogical. They teach us something. Mm-hmm. And so what the question we're asking is, historically, what have they been teaching us about working class identities? And I say identities plural purposefully because it's not a monolithic, homogenous identity, and we need to understand it as such. And so that's the complexity that the film tries to take into consideration. And I think this is really important because there's been this false binarism between political economy and material struggle and the symbolic sort of signifying systems. They need to be brought together. And the film tries to do that.
I think there's a way, on the most basic level, of looking at what we tried to do with the film, which is that when Pepe came to us with these boxes and boxes of VHS tapes, it's as if he had sort of brought us some cave paintings or some Grecian vases or African masks or something. It's like, television, especially entertainment television, tells us stories. It tells us who we are. It tells us who matters, who has power, who doesn't. That's the sort of thrust of the whole film, is that entertainment television really matters because it's telling us stories about our society. And so it was like he had unearthed some great archaeological find here when he brought us these tapes.
Yeah, and I think that's the great paradox. It's so visible, and yet it's so invisible, because while television, as Loretta said, brings that to us on a daily basis, it's part of our daily diet, the other agencies of socialization don't give us the critical skills to interrogate those images to realize, again, that they're teaching us not necessarily good things about the world. And so we need to start to take our entertainment more seriously and see this as not simply sitting back and laughing as we're overworked and underpaid and stressed out about life, but to start to realize that these images do have a real impact and historically have had a real impact on how people participate.
So maybe a good place to start would be to talk about how you define class within the film.
Well, again, that was one of the difficulties of putting the film together, and it was really great to work with Loretta on this to try to figure out how to fit all this in, because essentially we're taking, outside of the categories of race and gender and sexuality and so forth, we're taking up three important categories around class. And again, this is reductionistic because class is far more complex than this, but to find three grand patterns along the lines of economic class, which is how much money you have and how much capital you've accumulated, political class, which is the power you have to influence, you know, your everyday work life and the larger public political process, and then cultural class, which pertains more to, you know, education and lifestyle and leisure. And so we were trying to take those three up within these representations to see how all three play out, and all three play out in a way that's debilitating to working class identities, that degrades and is radically pejorative.
The film really does that. It takes up those three categories that Pepe just talked about and finds whatever the genre is, it finds sort of expression of those different ways in which people experience social class. That's not enough to sort of create the structure for the film, but that was really sort of the guiding principles. And the thing that we tried to do, set up to frame the film in the beginning, was that we can't understand the images that we look at. When we watch TV, we can't really go too much deeper unless we understand how social class works in the United States. And that's problematic because It's not talked about. It's not taught in school. It's not part of the popular discourse. It's everywhere in plain sight, but yet we don't talk about it because we like to think we're unique in some way in America, as we don't have an aristocracy. And we acknowledge that we do have a class system, but the discussion is never about the structural aspect of class. It's that people have some kind of class position, or people are rich or people are poor, or they're somewhere in the middle, but we don't have an understanding of the structural dimensions of class. And that is absolutely crucial to really understand that it's not just about individuals that we're talking about. We're talking about laws and institutions that are foundational and shape the way people experience their lives. And they're far more powerful than just individuals. When that kind of structural analysis is missing, then we really only see individuals. And yes, of course, America is unique in that we do have individual rights enshrined in our founding documents. That's a double-edged sword, because what it means is that, yes, people do have possibilities and opportunities, but then also it means that we blame the individual and we put it all on the individual, and we tend to look away from the way in which America was founded as a country founded on wealth and property rights, and the exclusion of those rights for other people, and the way in which those institutions such as slavery, the laws of slavery, benefited the slaveholder, not the slave. The laws benefited the factory owner and not the factory worker. And people have had to negotiate and fight for rights and freedoms around those institutions. And the institutions may have been abolished, as in the case of slavery, although we know that sharecropping and Jim Crow segregation and all that took the place of slavery. But the institutions may be abolished or transformed or reformed, but the institutional frameworks remain. And so we need to understand that there are those structures that are far more powerful, as I said, than individuals.
More basically, the structures we're talking about are based in free market capitalism, and there's a rigid ideology that protects those structures.
Sure, laws, government,
even the language free market, there's nothing free market about it. It's radically contained. It's federally subsidized. I mean, it's an interesting form of sort of socialism meets feudalism, and I'm a socialist, so I don't mean to diss socialism along those lines, but it's really incredible how these corporations have been able to monopolize the media. And again, the public owns the airwaves, and yet they've monopolized them to historically create these representations that make it look like if something's wrong with the economy, well, it's the working class. And that's always scripted, as Loretta was saying, outside of those larger structures of capital that subordinate people, that oppress people, and have historically done so. And so when you look at these images, what you get is this myth of meritocracy. Work hard and you'll be fine. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which presupposes you have bootstraps, which is already a class issue, let alone the American dream. Now, what's interesting about the American dream is it implies a class structure. You move from the bottom to the top. Mm-hmm. But the key with this ideology and the manipulation is, the way the propaganda works is, the onus is on you. If you don't work hard, if you don't make the proper choices, if you're not interested in education, if you don't have good taste, if you don't have the right politics, the right work ethic, then you have no one to blame but yourself. And these representations that we've found with the media historically have done just that. They don't take up capital. They don't take up tax programs that support the wealthy and diss the working class and the working poor and so on and so forth. That's what's really problematic about these representations. It's not that you can't be entertained by them. It's that they're inherently political, and yet part of that politic is disarticulated from the real struggles that most people in this country go through on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And before we talk more about the film around the representation of class, specifically in television, can you talk a little bit more about these myths and the role they play in perpetuating, protecting this economic structure? It's pretty insidious how the process works, or the system works, because it's not necessarily a bunch of CEOs of these media conglomerations sitting around planning and strategizing how they can screw the working class even more or betray the working class in very negative ways. It's more of a systematic process, wouldn't you say?
It's definitely more systematic. There aren't a bunch of, I don't want to comment on their moral character, but what happens is that the media is one of these institutions that I spoke of. In the same way that the laws of America favor capital and not workers, the laws favor big media. They favor the shareholders and the advertisers, and they don't favor people who consume the media, viewers, the public that owns the airwaves. And so the media is the cultural institution of those social and economic structures that we were talking about. And so they reproduce those ideas that we get about the self-made man, the American dream, the myth of meritocracy, level playing field, those things get played out within the media because the media is part of the institutional framework of capital and a class society.
But I think what's important also to add to that is we're talking about contextualizing this in a history of representation. So the stereotypes have been out there for a long time. That's already breathing life into itself because it's been around. So it's not like necessarily that producers and scriptwriters are sitting around going, hey, let's screw the working class and here's how to do it. It's already built into the culture. We've been called into that space. And so they know what's funny and what works. And when we watch it, you know, our desires mobilize. So we might laugh at something on The Simpsons, right? But we never call into question, why are we laughing? So that space is there. But at the same time, these corporate entities are run by people. People breathe life back into these institutional practices and socially sanctioned practices. So take someone like Rupert Murdoch, and he's very clear about his politics. They're fascist, you know, at best. They're incredibly conservative. And so it's not a conspiracy theory. He's protecting his best interests. Now, as the head of a massive media corporation, that's inevitably not going to trickle down, but waterfall down to what kind of shows get on the air. And interestingly enough, a lot of the shows that we used are on Fox. And so there is a conscious, I think, strategic effort in this era of globalization, which is more of neoliberalism and outsourcing and offshoring and downsizing and so on, to scapegoat the working class. And so I think both need to be taken up.
Bosses wiser.
Billy Bragg with Power in a Union. And you're listening to an interview by Tim Scott of the Bread and Roses Collective at Valley Free Radio in Northampton, Massachusetts, a brand new low-power FM station a few hundred of us gathered to help put on the air last summer.
I am in the studio today with Pepe Lystina, who is a professor of applied linguistics at UMass Boston, and Loretta Alper, who is a producer with the Media Education Foundation, located in Northampton, Massachusetts. We are talking about their new film called Class Dismissed, How TV Frames the Working Class. How is class represented in television? What did you find? How does the film portray that?
When we worked through the images and tried to figure out just time-wise how to fit this in, there was a lot that landed on the editing floor.
We looked at different social groups and the way that they, marginalized groups, and the way that they come onto television. We look at the way that women as a category or gender can be looked at separately in terms of the way that women and class intersect. We looked at genres, too. That was sort of another way of kind of framing the program. We looked at sitcoms and the ways in which we laugh at working class people. And then outside of that, we took up daytime talk shows and cop shows. The same ideological principles are operating, but they play out differently when we're talking about crime and when we're talking about deviance. And so when we're not laughing at the working class, there's another way in which we see them and don't necessarily talk about them in class terms.
But also just to expand the analysis beyond simply the economic conditions, sort of the old traditional look at social class, and to see that, no, gender can't be conflated with class, nor can race be conflated with class and so on, but they're inextricably linked, and to see how they play off of each other. And so we've expanded the look at class. And so it's not trying to force in, well, let's force in sexuality, let's force in gender, let's force in race, or again, to sort of reduce that to simply an economic base in some Marxist sense. It's really opening that up and seeing what these articulations are and what impact that they have.
There is also a historical dimension to it, too, in sort of looking at the early days of television and the early representations and who was there and how those images changed and the way in which television mirrored certain social struggles that were going on around class politics, racial politics, gender politics, and the way that those affected the representations. You know, TV is usually behind social movements, and when it catches up, how is it going to deal with, as Pepe said before, issues that corporate owners and advertisers really don't want to deal with? And so how are they going to frame, how are they going to admit people onto TV that they can no longer ignore? And one of the sort of overarching themes of television is that the middle class, or the idea of the classless middle, is the way that we can sort of neutralize class struggles, race struggles, struggles around sexual identity and racial politics and gender politics, and we can all just sort of be the same and participate in a kind of glorious consumer culture and the American dream. And so that's another kind of guiding theme thread that runs throughout the program, too, is this idea of the middle class and the way that sort of neutralizes and hides class politics.
And again, that's a conscious effort. That's a strategic effort. And that's what we tried to show historically. If you look from the birth of television on, especially when advertisers start to take over, there is a concerted, very conscious strategic effort to make sure that it becomes a consumer society, and that lifestyle and consuming goods is the goal. It's not about offering the public a sense of what's going on in the world and being what television should be, which is an informative space. And so that's not just random. That's people sitting in boardrooms and making conscious decisions about how advertising is really going to run the show, how we can't talk about a lot of these political issues. Not that these other issues aren't political. They are.
We brought some audio clips in so we could look at the ways in which a lot of these are cultural issues that Pepe spoke of, you know, the social, the political and the cultural are ways that people experience class. And we have a very long section that takes up the stereotypes that's called class clowns. And within class clowns, we broke that down into taste, education, work ethic, family values, and politics. And so within those five subcategories, we look at the sort of stereotypes around those issues related to people's cultural class identities. So should we play a few clips? Within the five categories that we identified as the failings of the working class, the reasons why they haven't made it, why they're still working class and haven't made it into the middle class or, you know, become Donald Trumps or more fabulously wealthy, which we see all the time on television. A major one that so many people identify with is the idea that the working class suffers from terrible bad taste. Bad taste in clothing, food, furniture, everything. And the other sort of idea implicit in that is that the working class wouldn't get it even if they were given the finer things in life, and so they're not really deserving of them. This is a clip that is set up by Susan Douglas, one of the interviewees in the program. The other idea in this clip is that also if you sort of give people the finer things in life, that you can kind of change their class status just through the acquisition of what we call cultural capital. So this is a clip from Yes, Dear.
You know, being working class seems kind of like a lifestyle choice where people, you know, like pink flamingos and tacky furniture in their house and don't have much taste.
Just trying to give your family a little culture. Bet if I shoved it in a hot pocket and smothered it in Velveeta, the four of you would be out back wrestling over it.
As if people choose to have lower incomes when class, in reality, is powerfully structured by social forces.
So you can hear the laugh track there. It's a pretty decent joke, and it gets a good laugh, but there's a lot implicit in that little clip. That's what television is constructed of, those moments every single day. And I think it's a really dangerous notion. You know, if the working class could just sort of be educated to the finer things in life, then that somehow will change people's class status. And that, of course, comes out of this notion of not really understanding that class is much more than your taste or your lifestyle.
Yeah, and I think what's fascinating about how they do this is they make it look like it's a choice. And if we look statistically at the country, I mean, the mean family income is about $44,000. There are 39 million people that live below the poverty level. There's 3.9 million people that are homeless, and 39% of those are kids. And stats go on and on, like that 45 million people that don't have health insurance. And so if we start to look at the material conditions of the working class and the working poor, and then, you know, reduce that to, oh, you're simply making bad choices. You should be eating the finer breads and drinking the green bottle beers. What's the matter with you? As opposed to saying, oh my gosh, why do so many people in this country not have the basic, you know, necessary funding to have the basic security like healthcare and a secure roof over the head and safety for their kids? That's a crime against what Michael Zweig calls 62% of the population. People that don't have power. They go to work, they do their job, and then they basically get these meager funds back for their hard labor, and that can barely sustain them, let alone allow them access to these finer things.
What better example do we have of blaming the victim than, you know, blaming people for not enjoying the finer things in life when, as a couple of our interviewees point out, taste, no one is born with good taste. One acquires taste through education, through one's social position. One is taught good taste. And taste is a matter of economics. People don't choose to eat macaroni and cheese several nights a week. Taste is structured by one's economic position. And that is all left out of that joke, of course.
What the person will come away with is seeing that the working class is portrayed pretty negatively within television.
Yeah, and I know people may resist that because they like these programs, and we're certainly not advocating what people watch or don't watch. That's not really the issue. What we're trying to get people to think of is to look at these patterns. We didn't make this stuff up. The patterns are there. There's a lot of just sort of watch TV with a more critical eye.
Well, it seems that since a majority of people in this country are working class, and that since a majority are seeing these images and they're seeing television programs that are mostly about middle-class families or upper-middle-class families and what the great lives they have. But then when working-class people see images or programs that represent who they identify with more, it seems to be more negative. But the corporations that are putting together these programs, as well as the advertisers funding them, probably understand this dynamic. And still, it doesn't really affect them. Of course, these programs are really more and more becoming vehicles for advertisers. And so they're seeing a lot of the mostly working class people who are watching these as consumers. So they're trying to appeal to them. But you would think it would just turn people off and say, screw that. I don't like how I'm being represented here. I'm not going to watch.
Which is class-based in and of itself, because look who's doing the representing. You know, boards and rooms full of, you know, well-paid producers and so forth. That's not the working class representing themselves. I mean, and that's where the problem lies. And again, if these are public airways, then there should be that diversification of images. And yet there's not. We get the same pattern from the same bunch of folks that we've historically gotten. And that's where the problem lies. The problem doesn't lie in that this show is funny. I mean, like I said last night on one of the radio shows, Doug Heffernan's a funny guy. The King of Queens is a funny show. That's not the problem. The problem is there is no alternative image or vision or representation of the struggles that the working class goes through on a daily basis. So it's not saying you can't be entertained, you can't laugh, sit back and enjoy yourself after a hard day, which is what we all need to do to de-stress so we don't snap. It's simply saying, gosh, where's the rest? And these images don't provide the rest. It's all consistently the same. Negative representations of lazy, you know, bumbling, not intelligent, you know, not wanting the better things in life, or in the other categories of women that are promiscuous and in a sense of race, you know, the criminalization of racially subordinated bodies and so on and so forth. That again, this isn't just picking one image to make the theory work. It's just consistent patterns of representation that don't get problematized, A, and B, that don't get countered by alternative images that people can sort of look at and say, that doesn't reflect what I see in the world. And so television becomes a dangerous pedagogical force. And I think that's what we're trying to do with the film, is to suggest that we need to think in alternative ways and more critical ways.
One of my favorite clips in the film is from The King of Queens. And it's an episode in which the company that Doug Heffernan works for is on strike. It's clearly meant to be a UPS-type firm that he's working for. And the drivers and the workers have gone out on strike. And they're shown on the picket line having a barbecue and sort of tossing around a beach ball, and everybody's just sort of chill and hanging out. For people who are working class and who have fought struggles, they know that that's not what the picket line is about. And also it completely ignores the historical reality, which is that UPS did go out on strike a number of years ago, and it was a successful strike, and that UPS and the Teamsters is a militant union. A Teamsters picket line would not involve sort of hanging out in beach chairs, smoking cigars and making fun of the whole thing. And that goes back to just what Pepe is saying, is that the counter images, the counter representations are completely missing. And so these images carry that much more weight because they're all that we see.
And it's important, too, to recognize that, again, that show isn't falling out of the sky yesterday, you know, or today, that there's a huge, long history to this. And so what we try to do with the film is look at that history also. And in particular, in the 50s, you know, looking at the McCarthy era of how unions were scapegoated and dissed and marked as communist and radical. And any attempt to, you know, democratize, you know, social and economic and technological relations get crushed, not only in the public sector, but also through representation. Again, that's strategic. And so that history, that legacy creates what I call the historical present. And so when we get Heffernan flipping cheeseburgers and his buddy sitting in a little kiddie baby pool, and that's the image of these union workers, which we know the stereotype is, they're a bunch of lazy buffoons that just want to get extra for doing nothing, that has a major impact. And we need to take that impact up so that we're not just seeing this as entertainment. We're seeing this as part of something that can influence public policy and how people participate politically.
All right, let's go to another clip. But before we do, I want to ask you about the wider attention this film is getting nationally.
We've got a few film festivals that we're in and a couple of labor conferences that we'll be at. And so the film is getting out there, and that's really exciting for us. And we hope to just keep going and just really make this part of the conversation.
You've got a big red carpet. Fabulous.
We're going to the belly of the beast, baby. We're going to Hollywood.
In Hollywood.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's next week. Third week in March, we'll be out in Hollywood. Class Dismissed was accepted to an independent film festival out there. Part of the program that we'll be in is sponsored by the AFL-CIO, and there'll be a lot of sort of industry heavyweights and organized labor heavyweights and a bunch of people talking about labor and class issues. So Pepe and I will be adding our voices to those discussions, and that should be interesting.
Well, hopefully there'll be a good amount of union workers in attendance if it's AFL-CIO.
They're doing a lot of advanced publicity for it, so we really hope to see a lot of people out there, a lot of working class people.
Great. And Sally Field's doing the introduction to the section State of the Union, so I'm dressing up as Mrs. Doubtfire, and Loretta's going as Gidget.
Yeah, it was a tough, we had to fight over the Flying Nun or Gidget, yeah. But yeah.
Pepe, I think you'd be better dressing up as someone like Big Bill Haywood or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Having the costume moves made is very difficult.
I hope you're getting the visual there.
I have a great body for radio.
Okay, back to these categories. Pepe mentioned that one of the damaging and demeaning myths about the working class is that they just really want a free ride. And everybody who is working class in middle class knows that we're all working harder than we ever have been, and many of us are barely making ends meet. And there's a stereotype on television that really perpetuates this idea that the working class is lazy and suffers from a really bad, poor work ethic. And so we brought two clips that demonstrate this. The first is from, there's dozens of shows in this program, and I'm forgetting the name of this one, but I'll get back to you on it. The second clip is from Cheers. So you'll recognize that one, hopefully.
And let me just throw in a quick little bit there. We have to keep this in mind as you're hearing these clips. Since the 1970s, productivity is up over 160%.
Right.
Wages are up, but they're down 115%. Right. But profits are up 758%. American workers are working really hard. They're getting paid less, and they're getting blamed for everything. And yet this is the representation that you'll get.
Actually, I'm a psychologist. If I wanted to be a psychiatrist, I'd have to go through medical school and residency and all that.
Yeah, I know how you feel, buddy. I was going to take the management course at work, but it's like three Saturdays.
Like today, I had to choose between two really great jobs. Couldn't make up my mind.
So what'd you do?
I skipped them both, came in here. I think I made the right choice.
As you can see from that clip, and the show's still standing, the situation comedy's still standing, he has no interest in moving up and improving his sort of lot in life and therefore his family's lot in life. So he's bad family values. He's lazy. You know, this is a single clip, but again, this pattern is across the board. It's just so thick with these kinds of images that we think are incredibly dangerous. And so it's really important for a film like this to get out there and to get people to think about this, again, to get them to take their entertainment seriously.
Just to shift gears, later in the program, we look at redneck image popularized by Jeff Foxworthy and Blue Collar TV. Could have done a whole program just on that phenomenon, Blue Collar TV. One of the things that we look at is the way redneck pride has kind of come back around to as a kind of racialized class identity for white people to get behind, and the way in which conservatives and Republicans have exploited that kind of cultural sense of class. Of course, leaving out the economic aspect of it, because certainly people who watch NASCAR and who identify as rednecks have very little in common with George Bush and the Republican Party and the elites that are exploiting them. And one of the things that I wish we could have done in the program is, for me, those pride images, the Jeff Foxworthy images, are kind of like they're an updated version of Archie Bunker and his character on All in the Family. That show is really about cultural class and the way in which Archie no longer identifies with the culture around him and what's happening in terms of women, blacks, minorities, gay rights, and what's happening culturally, and he feels left out of that. What really isn't dealt with that much in All in the Family is his identity, his economic class position. It's more about his cultural class position. And I think of Archie, and so consequently he is in opposition to all those groups because he is a conservative white man and he doesn't get where they're coming from. And I think about the possibilities if today to do a TV show where a character like Archie understands that he has more in common with black members of the working class, other members of the working class, immigrants, people who are doing this low-wage work that Archie did as a dock worker, and that possibility, but we don't see that. All we see is the kind of reactionary image of someone who's kind of struggling with the cultural issues that really have been exploited by the whole redneck pride and Republican agenda.
Television shows, it seems, really play upon and perpetuate a lot of those differences and those divisions that exist within the working class, mostly around race and gender. And a lot of the programs now, the more contemporary ones, out of a more kind of politically correct social perspective, you're seeing minorities and people of color, especially in their families, being portrayed as middle class and upper middle class.
Yes.
But when the overwhelming majority of them are low-wage earners, that's the crime.
Exactly. But having seen the rough cut of this film, some of the most intense clips came from some of the older programs, the Jeffersons, as well as the show Good Times, which were programs about African-American families.
Yeah, the post-civil rights era.
Wiping out the real struggles that people go through and the material conditions that they have to endure, those shows pastoralize ghetto life. They make it look like people are okay in the ghetto, living there is fine, they don't really need anything. And there's this major assault when you see historically of public policy and how it works, of wiping out social programs that are designed to help American people, not to be giveaways in the sense of bleeding liberals, but to help American people that are struggling. And those shows don't portray that struggle at all. If anything, they give us more of, as Robin Kelly says in the video, everybody's going to get off the island in the sense of Gilligan's Island. And so Good Times, they get off the island. Archie Bunker even gets off the island. They all do. And so again, feeding into the myth of meritocracy and the American dream, there really is no struggle and strife here. We just get to watch the process as entertainment and spectacle, not as a political process. And the fact that most people stay in their class position. And there is nothing fun about living in a ghetto. That's not a choice.
We have a Jefferson's clip, which we could listen to and then comment on if we wanted to.
Your family started at zero, and look what you've got now. A son going to college, a lovely wife, successful business, and a beautiful apartment.
And you did it all by yourself.
You can see how this would feed into the ideology of meritocracy. George Jefferson is a self-made man. He doesn't need help. He doesn't need help from the state. He just needs to work hard. And then the door is open to success. And we can see how this then moves into a show like The Cosbys, who, you know, as we argue in the film, aren't struggling to get there. They're already there. And so this idea that everybody can achieve a middle-class lifestyle if you just have the proper qualities and make the proper choices.
And again, that all that's required is the kind of right ambition and hard work. And we know that millions of people work extraordinarily hard. And yet access is limited in terms of what Pepe said before. Only a quarter of Americans actually leave their social class or change their social class. And that there are institutional barriers such as race and gender and sexuality. And also that wealth and power don't like to share and give up wealth and power. And so, yes, individuals do make it in America. We do know, and TV plays on this enormously and celebrates the idea of meritocracy and people moving up. But that is very, very limited, but it perpetuates this myth that it's the fault of the individuals who don't.
I think we should be talking about class mobility in the United States, but we should be talking about class downward mobility, because that's really what's happening. The middle class is imploding into the working class, which is imploding into the working poor. And the conservative agenda, now again, not that Democrats have done much for the working class lately, but the conservative agenda has always been an assault against the working class and the working poor. And so I think these representations, while they're fun and fluffy and entertaining, they need to be taken seriously so that we don't fall into that trap of voting for people that actually subvert our economic interests, let alone our other interests in society.
So that's a good place to end. How could people get a hold of this video?
MEF is largely sustained by institutional sales, and so we have kind of tiered system. We have a website, MEF.tv, where people can also get it. I think it's a slightly different price, but anyway, if you go to MEF.tv, the video is available at an individual price on that website as well.
I also want to say that class-based issue, that producing something like this film, that's not the problem. The problem is distribution, getting it out there. And there are powerful class-based interests that keep films like this out of the mainstream. So I just really want to thank you for inviting us on the show and making that, at least that crack of agency of distribution possible to get the word out there, just to get people to think about this. We're not trying to tell them what to think. We're just trying to get them to think.
Pepe Lystina and Loretta Alper, makers of the new documentary, Class Dismissed. They were speaking with Tim Scott of the Bread and Roses Show at Valley Free Radio in Northampton, Massachusetts. Also, where the Media Education Foundation is located, that's www.mef.tv. And thanks to Binghamton Indie Media and the staff of the Park School of Communications at Ithaca College for their assistance and contributions to this week's show. Some events coming up for listeners here in the Finger Lakes. On April 11th at noon, three American activists who have recently returned from Palestine will discuss their work in the occupied territories. That's Tuesday, April 11th at noon at the Borg Warner Room in the Tompkins County Public Library on Green Street in Ithaca. The event is free. Another free event also in Ithaca on April 21st. Writer and publisher and now Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate, Sander Hicks, will be sharing ideas on how to build a political mass movement. Sander authored The Big Wedding that addresses the 9/11 cover-up and is currently working on a second book, Meet the Future, Head On. That's Friday, April 21st, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Workers' Rights Center, upstairs at Autumn Leaves at 115 The Commons in Ithaca. Coming up this Tuesday in Rochester, that's April 11th, James Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, will speak on the peril of our modern urban landscape. How will our cities respond to the coming energy crisis? It will be held at the German House on Gregory Street in Rochester. This event is not free. Tickets are $10 in advance at Wegmans or Parkley, $15 at the door, and $5 for students. The event is organized by the Rochester Regional Community Design Center and the American Institute of Architects, Rochester Chapter. For more information, www.rrcdc.org, rrcdc.org. Or call Audrey at area code 585-271-0520. And you can contact us and download MP3s and podcasts of all 301 Unwelcome Guests episodes at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. Another brave man.